Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, true crime time, and as has been the case, I guess, the past few weeks, Jen and I have been searching for interesting kind of real life, hey, tie it into things that are going on in the world today, and in this particular case, can also be tied into things that Jen and I have discussed about Jeffrey Epstein. So, of course, it wouldn't be Friday without Jen. Jen, how are you?
I'm good, because it's the best day of the week.
It is. It is. what we have decided on, which I think is really interesting, is Jen had come to me and said, hey, you know, we should do something about war dogs. And then I said, oh, that's cool. And I said, there's another movie maybe we could tie it into, too. And I said, Lord of War. It's got Nicolas Cage and Jared Leto. And Jen found some amazing information on some of the people of Lord of War, because I never looked into Lord of War. You know, I just watched the movie. I've seen it several times. I really enjoyed it. And what I never thought about it in the sense of, you know, when you're watching and you go, he thinks he's going to be let off, because he knows stuff that the government wants, and that he's serving a useful kind of purpose for.
Yeah, it was an incredible recommendation. After I saw this movie, I mean, just the beginning of it, when the main character starts talking, things just start falling into place that match up to current events that are going on right now. And I was like, oh, man, we have to discuss this, because so many people have questions about what is and is not happening with certain things with Epstein and government stuff, and this might clear up a lot.
It does. And if, for those of you, maybe you haven't watched it in a while, go watch it. And it is much more realistic than something like War Dogs, which we might get around to talking about. but War Dogs is more of just, you know, a couple of stoners who got lucky and took advantage of, you know, a war that was going on. Well, this is something that is more systemic and ongoing. So one of the things is I had never looked to see, okay, who is this character that Nicolas Cage plays? Who is it based on? And there are different theories, because it seems to be multiple real life people that match certain aspects of his character.
When you look at this whole plot, it does match up to several gun runners and smugglers, at least five of them. And if you kind of are into intelligence history, CIA type stuff, and the gun runners themselves from multiple countries, you can tell which ones that the writers sort of played off of.
The main character, Orlov, he's loosely based on a guy named Victor Bout. And one of the things he says is, I carried multiple passports. I carried gems, rubies, bargaining tools. And Jeffrey Epstein essentially had those exact same items in his safe.
He did. And people question, why did he have gems or diamonds in his safe? And it's because those are bargaining tools. Also, he was a teetotaler. Why would he have any type of alcohol in his house when he didn't like to keep that around? Also, bargaining chips. Ghislaine carried multiple passports. He gets busted with that multiple passport. It was an Australian passport, expired 1987, but it had a false name with his photo. It had been stamped multiple times, so he had used it to enter and exit the country multiple times, and then a Saudi Arabian address.
Yeah, on the Austrian passport, which is crazy. And one of the things that Victor says, it's not the double life that gets you, it's the triple, which is really, really thought-provoking. When you're thinking about, okay, it's not the double life, it's the triple. And essentially, you know, that's what you had with Jeffrey Epstein. It's not this arms dealing kind of double thing. It was the triple, having also being a pedophile.
Yeah, that's where they go wrong. Same thing with Ghislaine. Then, of course, her father, Maxwell, what possibly led him to his deepest trouble, and literally deep water trouble, was the fact that he started off with one country, and then he didn't like what they were offering in the end, so he hopped to another country, and then he hopped to a third country and threatened to burn the first one. And you saw what happened to him. So you never want to do that. So that's the truest thing ever, is that it is the triple or quadruple life that ends up getting you.
So this Victor Bout, he is a convicted Russian arms dealer.
He is a monster, like incredible in that industry. Like they can't say enough about him.
No, I mean, his nickname is the Merchant of Death.
It is.
Here's one of the things. He smuggled arms and other merchandise through several aviation company fronts. And again, what we have with Epstein and then Wexner mm-hmm. is the Southern Air Transport, because you need a way to ship these things to the various countries. You can't just put them on FedEx.
Right. So Victor Bout, he used his Air Cess aviation shell front. And then you have Epstein, and he uses at first Hoffenberg's jet to do some of his more shady deals. And then he moves on to Wexner, and then he moves on to acquiring the CIA's Southern Air Transport, which was Air America before that. So you can kind of see a pattern in this. And the fact that Jeffrey Epstein was allegedly an arms dealer or dealing with arms dealers in the 1980s before he graduated to his honeypot situation, it makes his story just a little bit just more easy to follow, I guess.
Yeah. And so, you know, and just much like Nicolas Cage's character in Lord of War, you know, Nicolas Cage had this advantage in it because he could speak Russian, and, you know, Bout obviously is a convicted Russian arms dealer. And he operated essentially in Eastern Europe and Africa and the Middle East. And like I said, he was nicknamed the Merchant of Death and also the sanctions buster, because he would do anything to bypass embargoes and stuff, which, you know, eventually kind of brought him down. Now, one of the characters in the movie is based on this guy named Lee Woolsey. And he is an American diplomat. He's an attorney. And he served under the last three U.S. presidents in national security positions, and is currently a partner at Boies Schiller Flexner. Now, the Boies has been in the news a lot and directly into Epstein, because David Boies, represents Virginia Roberts and also some others. But at the same time, they, like I said, it doesn't even match with, you know, the defending of representing Virginia and stuff, because they were they'd kind of drawn a lot of hate for the way that they aggressively represented Harvey Weinstein. And it just kind of the antithesis to what they're doing with some of the Epstein victims. And also, David Boies and this firm, they also were big supporters of Theranos, and kind of put their head in the sand and really talked up Theranos to a bunch of people.
Yeah, and if no one knows what Theranos is, that's that blood testing startup company that had no vetting and no real scientific research backing it when it began.
Yes, and there's a great documentary on Theranos, by the way, that I encourage everybody to watch. And one of the things is Boies Schiller also has this tie to intelligence companies, because remember, the New Yorker reported in November of 2017, when all of Weinstein's, you know, world was crashing down, that Boies Schiller directed private intelligence companies, including Black Cube, to spy on and orchestrate smear campaigns against victims of Weinstein's and on reporters who were investigating Weinstein's actions. So, I mean, and Black Cube is essentially just, you know, Mossad. I mean, it's, you know, former intelligence officers and things like that. So you have this, you know, the diplomat and attorney who's now at this place, and he has all these connections to intelligence services. And they also represent Amazon and corporate matters. And Bezos got Boies Schiller as part of his crisis management team when Bezos was going through this extortion by AMI about him having an affair.
Yeah, definitely. So he's, let's say, the fixer, so to speak, the smooth person who has had a lot of experience in intelligence and stuff. He knows how to reframe the conversation and get his clients out of a lot of hot water. The thing about this guy is that he is someone who physically went after Victor Bout. It's because Victor Bout was linked to alleged links to Taliban and Al-Qaeda and helping them get arms deals and things like that. So he's going to be the guy that pursued that gun runner.
Yeah, it's interesting how this, the U.S. will turn a blind eye to any kind of maybe arms violations as long as it's going to the people that they are supporting. However, what Victor was doing was, like you said, supplying, you know, guns and everything to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and that was just too much for the U.S. government to kind of overlook.
Well, yeah, and that's what he's talking about when you get in trouble being a double, triple, quadruple agent. You know, you start jumping country to country. You better know what you're doing because, you know, the counterintelligence is not going to like that. The thing about Victor Bout, for those that like to keep notes on Maxwell, is that Victor Bout did a lot of business out of Bulgaria, and so did Maxwell. So if you want to look into those ties, they're there.
Yeah, and it seems like when you look at this arms dealing world, it's a fairly small world. There's all these people that, you know, whenever we talk about something, we talked about that. Well, we talked about that with Epstein. We talked about that with Khashoggi. We talked about it. There's very few names, and they all seem to just keep popping up in, in these strange circumstances. And it's not that big of a world. But when you think about how come, Epstein's, like Ghislaine, how come nothing's happened to her yet? And then you realize, okay, well, she knows a lot of this stuff too. There was, there's this Russian organized crime boss. I can't even, Semyon Yudkevich Moglievich. Let's just go with that. But he's described by agencies in the European Union and U.S. as the boss of bosses of most Russian mafia syndicates in the world. Now, he directs this vast criminal empire. The FBI has described him as the most dangerous mobster in the world, and he's accused by the FBI of weapons trafficking, contract murders, extortion, drug trafficking, and prostitution on an international scale. Now, he's not sending out the prostitutes, but he's at the top of the ladder, and all of these things are going on.
Yeah, and where have we heard that before? You see that a lot of times where the actual person who is running it or perhaps overseeing it, maybe not on the actual intelligence level, but the man overseeing it is not actually on site. He's viewing it from elsewhere.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, and this is kind of leading us to Epstein, because this is another person who has the nickname Merchant of Death, is a guy named Sarkis Garabet-Soganlian. But he is an Armenian Lebanese international private arms dealer, and he gained fame for being the Cold War's largest arms merchant and the lead seller of firearms and weaponry to the former government of Iraq under Saddam Hussein during the 1980s. Okay, so this is the U.S. was happy about that at that time because Iraq was fighting Iran. And the U.S. was, hiding behind the scenes, supporting Iraq in this war against Iran. So this is how he kind of boosted himself. And at the time, he was a permanent resident of the U.S. and he was living in Florida. And he was actually hired on behalf of the CIA to sell the arms to help Iraq in the midst of the Iran-Iraq war. He's hired by the CIA. But then
because these people are necessary, and I know it sounds at times really, really bad, but the thing is that what the United States government or intelligence agencies cannot exactly put their fingerprints on, they have to contract that work out, so it becomes a necessary evil. These people put their prints on what others can, and it's just work that is freelanced out. These are guns for hire, and, some of these guys are brought in by, say, the CIA or other intelligence agencies with the DOD, or like when the Bush administration came in, there's open contracts and you can bid. And you said it was something about it being a small circle. Well, it is. And while the bidding is open to anyone, they don't let just anyone stay in. If someone bids and they don't like you or you're just too competitive, they will run you out. And by run you out, I mean threaten to cut your head off. So the people that stay in that you see the names repetitive, it's because they are tolerating each other.
Yeah. So you had, this guy, I'm just going to call him Sarkis, who is hired by the CIA, but then the Justice Department, when you have one branch of the government not exactly knowing what the other is, they charged him for conspiracy of shipping unauthorized weapons to Iraq. And, he was. But he'd been hired by the CIA to do it. But so he was found guilty. He was sentenced to jail. And but what happened is he was sentenced to a fairly long term, but he got out after just a couple of years because the U.S. government needed his help again. In this particular case, it was with the Clinton administration because they wanted his help to break up this huge counterfeiting ring in Lebanon. It was unsuccessful, but he got out of jail anyway for it because he knew stuff. He knew, you know, people to call. He knew people to contact. This is the same kind of thing as Epstein, which we'll talk about later on, where, you know, Acosta says, you know, that he is, you know, intelligence or whatever. So anyway, so you have Sarkis and, okay, you know, he said, I've been set up, so now I'm just going to move from the United States. And he opens up operations in France and in Jordan. In 2001, he was arrested again by the U.S. government, this time on bank fraud charges. But what happened?
They have to cut him loose because then he starts squealing about how he's finally in with the CIA and he has equipped him with all these huge helicopters and grenade launchers. And they're like, okay, let's stop right there because this sounds really bad. And he's threatening to go public. So, yeah, they have to cut him loose.
Because he has intelligence. So he was released a year later because he revealed weapons transactions deals were taking place between the CIA and Peru. And this resulted in the collapse of the Peruvian government at that time. I mean, so this is the CIA doing this, and then he gets arrested and charged with some crazy thing. So he goes, I'm just going to spill the beans. And so then what happened was his testimony exposed the role of American government officials in this illicit arms trade. And, you know, I think Congress noted at that time that his revelations were found to be extremely disturbing to every American. And at the same time, he decides that, hey, I'm going to talk to you guys about how this kind of official and unofficial American involvement in the buildup of arms to Saddam Hussein. And the next thing you know, his testimony led to the Bush administration to open criminal charges against him in 1991.
So you see a series of these people constantly getting in trouble and then sort of getting off on technicalities. And then if they push it to the grade the way this guy did, you know, you see them continuously getting tangled up.
So that was how he got convicted in 1991. And it was 6 counts of possessions of arms and intent to sell to Iraq. He was selling 103 helicopter gunships from Hughes Corporation and 2 rocket-propelled grenade launchers, okay? And like I said, he was fined $20,000 and sentenced to 6 years in prison. But Clinton said, okay, we need your help. again, and it's just, it's crazy to me that all this happens because this counterfeiting operation, I guess, that was going on was $100 billion counterfeiting operation that was happening in Lebanon. I don't think people really understand that that was going on. And this counterfeiting operation obviously was being used to finance terrorism and things like that. And so they wanted his help to break it up. And, you know, he wasn't successful, but like I said, he got out anyway. So one of the other people that Nicolas Cage's character was based on is this guy named Edwin Paul Wilson. And he, I mean, it just keeps going on and on. He is also a former CIA and Office of Naval Intelligence officer, and he was convicted of, in 1983, of illegally selling weapons to Libya.
Yeah, but so this guy, too, sets up, again, a shell company. His is called Maritime Consulting Associates, and he decides that he's going to help them ship arms. And he does.
And so it was later, yeah, I mean, this guy, because it was later found out that the United States Department of Justice and the CIA had covered up evidence in the case.
Well, of course they did, because at the end of the day, they're unfoiling things that could just be absolutely disastrous way down the road. You know, like say that Lebanese criminal counterfeit ring. Well, that sounds like, oh, just some people forging things. No, it's like funding terrorism. And the only way to get rid of that is to cut off their legs, you know, cut off their funding. So this is kind of how this stuff begins. But yeah, it sounds bad.
So this Wilson guy, his convictions were overturned and he was freed. And then he started, you know, setting up more front companies and
With the help of the CIA, so he continues on with them.
Yeah. You know, it's just he.
And the thing is that people keep saying, "Where did Epstein get all of his money?" And I just keep looking at him like, "Are we still there?" Because this guy right here amassed a fortune of over $20 million within just a few short years. And how did he do it? Through the CIA. You know, intelligence can make you very rich. If you know what you're doing, speak multiple languages, and can help be like a supply chain guy, you're good.
Yeah. So you have, okay, so he gets 20 million bucks in a couple of years through these businesses, and he was offering these covert shipping services at the request of the CIA after his retirement. And then another scandal broke out when a company he had formed to ship United States military aid to Egypt was convicted of overcharging the United States Department of Defense by $8 million. And then a partner with Edwin Wilson in this company was another former CIA officer, a guy named Thomas Kleins. And then Wilson also maintained that Major General Richard Secord was also a silent partner in this company, though Secord denied this.
Now that guy's going to be interesting, because what is he linked to?
He is linked to Iran-Contra.
Yes, he is.
He's skipping my head for a second.
No, you got this, because you cover it all the time and you're so good at it, is that he is one of the people that Oliver North allegedly approached, and he began to talk about arming the Contras, you know, helping to get them arms and stuff. And these guys are the ones they lined up to do it. And then you look at the same timeline. Look at it. It's 1984. You have early 80s. Epstein came in around that time and was talking to a similar defense contractor. He's also traveling back and forth and dealing with a lot of these same Iran guys, same people that are involved in the Contra affair. So all of these are aligning.
So after an investigation by the Department of Treasury, which kind of was in charge of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So Wilson gets indicted by the Justice Department for firearms and explosive violations. One of the things, yes, he was convicted and all this stuff, but, you know, his defense is, hey, the government hired me to do this, and now the government's prosecuting me for this. But he was in Libya at the time, and Libya wouldn't extradite him. But, I mean, you're living in Libya, so he wasn't really happy there. And also the Libyans were kind of suspicious of him, and he thought, well, any day I'm going to end up dead. So
and he would have. So you know how they get all messed up in this, is that they're on board with the United States or whatever country that they're working for, and it's working out for a little bit, and then say they get stubborn. They either want more money or they slam the brakes on something. They want to go their other way. And then the intelligence agency says, not so fast. We own you outright. You're going to finish. And he's like, no, I'm going to stay in Libya. And they're like, okay, well, we'll just send somebody in to get you. So they can make your life just very miserable. And so this guy, you know, like you said, he's in Libya. He thinks he can't be extradited, but they send people to Libya and make him start fearing for his life.
Yeah. And so they convinced him, okay, you know what? You'll be safe in the Dominican Republic. And so he flew to the Caribbean, and as soon as he landed, he was arrested and flown to New York. And then he filed a civil lawsuit against 7 former federal prosecutors, 2 of whom are now federal judges, and a past executive director of the CIA. But a U.S. district judge dismissed his case on the ground that all 8 had immunity covering their actions.
See there? And that explains, Ghislaine, when people say, why hasn't she been hauled in? There is so much red tape right now, considering what's coming out of her mouth with immunity deals, Acosta, previous deals prior to even meeting Acosta. The guy literally said they were released on the grounds that they had an immunity covering their actions. So that part is huge.
Yeah, so then there's also this character, which is thinly disguised in Lord of War, Colonel Oliver Southern, which is essentially Oliver North. And so, again, you know, Oliver North's known for the involvement in the Iran-Contra scandal, and which, of course, you know, you had Adnan Khashoggi, and I've talked about him before, but again, he's just a Saudi-born arms dealer, the most prolific weapons dealer of his era. A guy who hung out with Epstein all the time. This was Epstein's hero. Khashoggi brokered deals with governments, arms manufacturers, private clients across the globe. He traveled the world by a private jet. He brokered secret deal of weapons by the U.S. government to Iran when it was supposed to be under an arms embargo. And that was done so that Iran would release the U.S. hostages that they had that time, and also fund the Contra Rebellion in Nicaragua on behalf of the U.S. And that all became public in about 87, which is about when Epstein was full on.
Yeah, he was full on meeting defense contractors. Adnan was one of them. And then, of course, you have the whole story about Epstein possibly being involved in arms or wanting to look into that. He's traveling to a lot of the same places as Khashoggi was. And also, there is the story about him going to a London home. So somehow he was able to take a British arms dealer, a New York style police issued pump. I think it was like a pump action riot gun. And no one could figure out how he got into the country. Well, probably because he had a card that said, I'm intelligence and, you know, don't approach me. So, again, all of that stuff, it aligns.
Yeah. And, you know, so Epstein, remember, was fired after a probe by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission because they had found that he had committed illegal securities violations with one of his clients. And so Stephen Hoffenberg, who was kind of the original partner of Epstein, he said that Epstein moved to a job where he was based in England and other parts of the world where the companies of Douglas Lease, the arms dealer, operated. Hoffenberg met Epstein through an arms dealer, Douglas Lease. And Hoffenberg said that in Europe, Epstein was involved in investment banking, money laundering, arms sales, and intelligence gathering. He also claims that Epstein had stolen substantial amounts of money from Douglas Lease by skimming off the top of the money transfers that he was involved in. Regardless of that, Mr. Lease was impressed by Epstein and believed his skills and experience on Wall Street could help Hoffenberg and his firm Towers Financial, which, of course, was the huge Ponzi scheme kind of thing. But in this, there's a book out called Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Lies. And it's claimed in that before meeting Hoffenberg during, you know, his time in Europe, that's when Epstein became involved with Khashoggi. And, you know, in addition to the arms stuff that we've always talked about with Khashoggi, he was also one of Colombia's biggest drug traffickers because he had all these things. He would move narcotics out of the country during the 80s and 90s.
He was a guy that could get anything supply chain wise. If you need weaponry, ammo, munitions, drugs, women, he could supply it all. And the thing is about Hoffenberg is that I think that he is the one who gave Epstein probably his biggest hop on international travel or just traveling in general, because in 1988, he gets with him. Hoffenberg has the plan to get with Epstein and take over that Emery Air Freight Corp.
Yes,
which
exactly.
They were unsuccessful in obtaining, but they continue on their path on Hoffenberg's private jet. And then Epstein goes on to burn Hoffenberg essentially, and he goes to prison, doesn't he, for that whole Ponzi scheme, and Epstein comes out smelling like a rose.
And you know why my theory on that, okay, is that, well, here's the thing. So Epstein told friends at that time contemporaneously that he was working as a CIA agent. You know, whether that's true or not, I mean, he became a millionaire essentially by committing fraud while working with Hoffenberg. And, you know, Hoffenberg was chairman of this company, and he said that Epstein was a key figure in this billion-dollar Ponzi scheme. But he said the loot from the scam wasn't enough for Epstein, who also stole cash from Towers by transferring the money directly into his own account. But if Epstein was selling arms and all of these kind of things and was a CIA agent or working for the Saudi government or working for the Israelis or the Austrians or whatever, the fact that he managed to avoid any kind of arrest even with all this huge, massive Ponzi scheme, it's probably because he had some information to give about somebody else that was more important.
Or he had like some severely high clearance. You know, Hoffenberg was left in the dust and Epstein was operating under, you know, basically handlers, people that he was doing exactly what they wanted him to do. And he was on a blueprint, so to speak. So he just kept evading arrest, evading the law on purpose because he had to continue on.
And it was during this period in the late 80s that Epstein, you know, first met Les Wexner. And, you know, if you think about it, I mean, this is a guy who gave Epstein, who's essentially, I mean, when it comes down to it, a con man, full power of attorney over Wexner's business affairs. I mean, the relationship was just weird if you think about it, if you're looking from the outside. Because if you're on Wall Street and you say, okay, this guy Epstein, who got fired for SEC violations and has been in Europe and running with this crazy crowd, touched a Ponzi scheme, and all of a sudden, you know, you're Les Wexner, who has enormous wealth, and he gives the money to some guy that most people had never heard of.
Yeah, it is odd, because Epstein, he pops up overnight somehow. Well, after he burns Hoffenberg, he hooks up with Wexner immediately. He funds that whole the J. Epstein bank thing that's offshore. He starts that and then picks up Wexner. He starts taking over that guy's entire life, including helping him develop a neighborhood that he was working on that was failing. Epstein brought that back to life and made it successful. He goes on to develop the Limitless yacht, and then who knows what they went on to use that for. But everything to do with Wexner has got, you know, Epstein's signature on it. And the Wall Street people were just going like, how? You know, what did those two guys really have in common?
You know, and I've often said that Wexner was, I mean, because I think that, you know, this mafia connection with Wexner and others in there, the DiBartolo family, and it's just kind of this natural thing. And Wexner had the ability to get Southern Air Transport and to buy it and to move it up to Columbus from Miami. I think that Epstein, because Epstein was great at blackmailing, and as the, you know, if he's the front for some intelligence agency, then he starts blackmailing Wexner. Because, I mean, Wexner gave him the house in Manhattan, gave him the house in Columbus, which he, you know, turns around and then ends up buying Little St. James Island. I mean, Wexner was the financial, you know, piggy bank for Epstein, and whenever he needed something and could help move things, because Wexner's got this, you know, multinational corporation where he is, you know, the one with the power, the one with the name. One thing that I found really interesting, and I think it was with Wexner had this yacht, right? And apparently there's a story that Ghislaine always wanted to go on the yacht, and she would be on the phone and she'd call the captain of the yacht and say, I'd really like I'm going to take the yacht out today. And the captain will say, well, I need to have the owner's permission before you can do that, the owner being Wexner. And Ghislaine could never get on that yacht. And according to the boat's captain, she tried this 6 or 7 times, and his feeling was that she was probably around girlfriends or something like that, and trying to show them that she could get on a yacht whenever she wanted. And I thought that was kind of an interesting story, because then she moves on to Ted Waite, and who had a yacht, and that, you know, becomes her boyfriend for a while. But anyway, that's a little sidetrack, and we can talk about that later. But one of the things, according to Hoffenberg, is he said that he gave authorities mountains of evidence that would implicate Epstein in the Ponzi scheme. But the thing is, Jeffrey's name just kind of vanished from the case, and he did cooperate with prosecutors, but what did he give them in a billion-dollar Ponzi case that gets him off the hook?
Apparently his life, because he went on to work in several things for them. You have to remember, prior to his Manhattan living situation, he had the spacious townhouse, and that was a former Iranian government building, and it was allegedly not given to him, but leased to him, perhaps by the State Department. And then, you know, he went on to feel so comfortable with them that he ends up subleasing it and getting in trouble. But I mean, to have the State Department give you housing to begin with, way back then, you know, I think that was like 92 at least. So he was already hanging out with arms dealers, traveling the country, and now the State Department is giving him housing. You know, he was building obviously an intelligence career. And then you have all these guys that he's friends with that are wrapped up in Iran-Contra. They're wrapped up in Southern Air Transport. Southern Air Transport follows these guys all around, and they go on to follow Wexner to Columbus in a deal that they said they couldn't turn down.
Yeah. In this book, this Dead Men Tell No Tales, it's written by Israeli intelligence officer Ari Ben Menashe. And he said that Epstein didn't work with
Mossad. That guy is legendary.
Yeah. He said that Epstein didn't work with Mossad. He said that Epstein was working with military intelligence, which he says it's a big difference. He never worked with Mossad, and Robert Maxwell never did either. It was military intelligence. And Ben Menasche claimed that Robert Maxwell was Epstein's kind of tie-over, that Robert Maxwell was the conduit in the Iran-Contra scandal, the financial conduit. And Ben Menasche said that he worked with Robert Maxwell, who introduced his daughter and Epstein to Israeli intelligence, after which they engaged in a blackmail operation for Israel. Quote, Epstein was taking photos of politicians effing 14-year-old girls, if you want to get it straight. They, Epstein and Maxwell, would just blackmail people. They would just blackmail people like that, he says in the book. And one of the things is there was a television network in Israel, I guess, that got a hold of Ben Menasche. And they were screaming at him, and they were saying, Israel wouldn't do this, you know, 14-year-old girls kind of things. And he said, you know, they kind of would. If you want to blackmail somebody, you sometimes have to do things that maybe are not, you know, something that you approve of, but you're trying to get the upper hand on somebody.
Because it needs to be something that is so salacious and so horrific that the person wouldn't want it released. So, I mean, what's worse than child trafficking or, you know, catching them in a prostitution situation, something like that? I mean, none of the intelligence agencies are above utilizing that. The stories, they're out there.
One of the things that's always, you know, if you think about Southern Air Transport, the CIA thing, you know, Wexner had, billions of dollars. He could have essentially, you know, had any airline, bought any airline cargo. There's a lot of cargo companies out there, but he chose that one. You know, it's out of all the airlines in the U.S., out of all the cargo companies, they chose the airline, the only airline. I mean, there's others, but nobody really knows what they are. So they picked the one that everybody knows is a CIA front, which is, you know, hey, we're hiding it in plain sight. Southern Air Transport, you know, you guys know what it did. We're doing it now. Something everybody always talks about, oh, you know, Epstein would say he's a CIA agent and all this kind of stuff. But there is actual documentation of a report. There's a British journalist by the name of Nigel Rosser, and he wrote in 2001. So actually, he's writing it in 2001 that Epstein claimed he worked for the CIA in the 1990s. So this is before Epstein gets in any kind of trouble. This is when Epstein, in this 2001 kind of time frame, this is when, you know, Clinton's riding on the jet. This is a lot of that kind of stuff. This is before anybody can, you know, say, oh, as soon as I found out, I stopped talking to him kind of period. So 2001, Epstein claimed that he worked for the CIA in the 1990s. So that's just, and, you know, it's this British journalist, it's Evening Standard, which is a quality publication. So I'm sure it was fact checked.
Told people that were close to him, just a few select people, and it came out way later, but he told them that he was a CIA agent and operating for intelligence and to basically look away from some of the stuff that he was doing. But this is before people realized about the trafficking and all that. He meant look away from the arms dealings and the Ponzi schemes and things like that. He was trying to justify to the Bear Stearns colleagues and stuff from the past what it was he was doing. So I tend to think that story is solid because Bear Stearns people told it.
Yeah. And one of the things, I brought up Ted Wade a minute ago, and in the last couple minutes here, I just want to be the way that it's presented is that Ghislaine, because she had trouble accessing the yacht of Wexner, that she purposely decided that she was going to go after this guy. And he is a tech billionaire. He's the co-founder of Gateway Incorporated. And he became Ghislaine's boyfriend after she, quote-unquote, broke up with Epstein. The yacht's name is quite interesting. It's called Plan B. and Ghislaine helped him obtain the yacht, renovate the yacht. This is essentially why she started dating. She just is – yachts to her were you have made it. And I think that maybe she got that from her dad, maybe from all the time she spent with Khashoggi, that yachts were the thing.
Yeah. So, and what did we talk about? Why do they want yachts? They can go out to international waters. They can conduct their businesses with no ears and no eyes. And Ted Waits came along with some baggage, his very good friend. I think that's the prize that she was after.
Yeah, and the thing is, so at this time, he was writing checks, and not just for the yacht, but also to get her places at conferences. And this is, you know, where she started with that Terra Mar project, where she would use for cover to get, you know, at these conferences where you're meeting government leaders, you're meeting things like that. And when he had met Ghislaine, you know, Ted Waite had this graying ponytail. He was just a total geek in the way that he kind of dressed. And then after she became his girlfriend, he shaved his head, started wearing tinted glasses, and you couldn't tell him apart from like Jason Statham. Now, here's the thing. On this yacht, there was a submarine, and it was put aboard there by Ghislaine, and she knew how to pilot it. She began deep sea diving, which she said is how she had discovered all the human-made debris all over the ocean floor. But it's interesting that they put a submarine on there and that she knew how to pilot it. Because I never knew that until the last week when I was kind of digging into this Plan B yacht. It seems kind of odd that they
had
one.
It does, but yeah, remember she constructed that yacht, so she would have laid out the blueprints for it, and she was thinking all along, you know, everything that she needed, everything that she wanted to go along with it. And Ted Waite is, of course, was best friends with Clinton at the time. I don't know if he still is friends with him, but they were very tight at that time, and she had her eye basically on that prize. She wanted to be on the yacht with that guy.
And that's how she got introduced not introduced because she already knew them, but, you know, Ted Waite donated $10 million to the Clinton Foundation, and that helped Ghislaine keep that access to the Clintons. And, you know, that kind of, gave $10 million or whatever. And that kind of kept her going into all of this. And it just, when you look at the arms dealers and everything, and you just go back, and Acosta had no reason when the non-prosecution agreement, he had no reason to lie about Epstein. I think that he was just trying to explain it. And he said at that time, you know, they said, you know, Epstein's intelligence. And as I've said many, many times, he had to get permission from somebody to cut that deal. He was the U.S. attorney for, you know, southern part of Florida. His boss was the attorney general at the time. And the attorney general, you know, reported to Bush. Bush has had a lot of ties to Saudi Arabia. We already have Jeffrey Epstein with the Saudi Arabian address in the Austrian passport. We have numerous visits from Jeffrey Epstein to Saudi Arabia. I have no doubts that he was told Jeffrey Epstein's in intelligence. I'm not sure that – I think he probably regrets actually saying that out loud.
I think it was probably said maybe in a heated debate. You know, maybe someone pushed him a little too far, and he said, look, he's above your pay grade. He's intelligence. Just back off, because then you start getting into just the red tape of logistics, diplomatic relations, and all that stuff. It can be a huge headache. So maybe he just came out.
I think that it did, because and if it hadn't come out, if he hadn't said that, you know, then you would have just had the normal, oh, well, you know, it was a deal. We didn't really think that we could win the case. And so we just kind of cut this deal, and it was the best that we were going to get at the time, something like that. But the problem is because he said that sentence out loud, then everybody starts digging into Epstein more and more and more. And as I've said numerous times, when you look at Little St. James and all that, people always are trying to say, okay, well, you know, did Clinton go? Did these actors go? Did, you know, all these other people? And you have to look at the fact that he mostly used it. Yes, he used it to rape girls, but he also used it to meet arms dealers where they could go and be comfortable in the Caribbean, kind of a neutral site, and, you know, have their meetings. And
yeah. So basically he had his own little embassy.
Yeah. And it was a place that he knew wasn't being, you know, tapped or anything like that. And he could meet, you know, anybody he wanted there. And I think people forget all that. And when you're talking about intelligence and Epstein, and then when you look at Lord of War and all these characters, real life people that the one character is based on, and you see the treatment that was afforded to them and the deals that they were able to cut with the government for these serious, serious things, it's not surprising that Epstein managed to, because they probably thought, prosecutors said, oh, you know, it's just some, you know, fairly poor people and they're not going to cause a fuss, so let's just make the deal. And I don't think that they knew at the time what that would, you know, turn out to be. I'm not sure that they would have made that deal. Maybe they would have just killed him then. Because it is because of what Acosta said with that line, it's above pay grade intelligence that caused people to keep digging, caused people to keep investigating, and that some of the people, you know, that I've seen, a lot of those victims started speaking up and they spoke up and they couldn't believe that this deal
and the fact that they weren't kept told. Going after he was released, yeah. He continued to meet with the girls, continued on the wild behavior. And I think that was the deal breaker for everyone involved, which probably
because he thought he was invincible. That's why, because he thought he had enough information about the government or everything else to go on that he was untouchable because. And, you know, for a long time, it appeared that he was right. It took almost a decade, really, for even the lawsuits to come forward or anything like that. So, you know, in a way, he was right. And then, you know, he got killed.
Definitely.
I'm convinced that Ghislaine's never going to be brought to any kind of justice, that she knows something or...
Well, no, she's sitting at the, kind of, you know, the in and out pictures, the fake ones. Her reading that CIA book, you know, was a huge message.
So, and you're kind of breaking up a little bit, but yeah, I think that Ghislaine and everybody else, because the same information that was available at that time, was when Epstein was arrested, you know, they had all that information. They could have done the same thing they did with her. So,
yeah.
I don't know if I lost. Are you there?
I'm here. Yeah. We had a little bit of a shaky connection, but I'm here.
There you go. I don't want to lose you again. So I think that we can end it there. And, perhaps next week we will talk about War Dogs, but perhaps not. But anybody, I encourage you to go watch Lord of War. And just, and then think about it and think about that at that time that Lord of War takes place is the time that Jeffrey Epstein was operating to.
Yeah, it's a really good movie. So anyway, and I'm glad that you recommended it.
I hope everybody has a great weekend. Yes. So, have a great weekend. And Jen, we will see you back here next Friday.
Okay. Thank you.